First thing I have to do today is to fix the thing that melted down in the end of last class. And the resolution was stupid in the end. It was, you know, if I just did the calculation I told you I was doing, it would have worked. So let me start that and then get back to where we're going. And I'm trying to also, this is, you know, of the 6 days we have these lectures, this is the third one. So we have 3 left. So maybe we should do this first. So today I was going to try and finish all the preliminary stuff. So the canonical quantization, I'm gonna just quickly mention path integrals, and then the Dirac field, which I know you've seen, but I wanna kind of put it into the context of this representation way of thinking about it. And then that gives us the tools to do something. So then the question is, what we do is up to us a little bit. And so I'd like it to have a loop theme to it. And then beyond that, it's a little bit, there's lots of loops you could do. I'd like to also have infrared divergences in it. And that's my only overlay. So if you don't have to say right now, but if you have specific topics you want to see done, you know, just suggest it to me, and then we have some flexibility as to where we go in the remaining lectures. So the thing, you know, the last thing I screwed up last time, you know you're making bad life choices if you have to fix a problem from a previous lecture in the next lecture. And so you remember what the we're in the process of you know, the observation was that these correlation functions of gradients of fields or correlation functions of pairs of spin one massless fields had non-covariant pieces to them. And the claim was that they could be canceled by non-covariant terms in the Hamiltonian. And then the pitch for canonical quantization was that it's an algorithm for generating those non-covariant interactions in the Hamiltonian that you need to do that cancellation. So it's not like you have to kind of every time from scratch try and figure out what's the magic cancellation I have to do. And I was trying to take you through these two examples to see that happen in practice. And the two examples where we've seen the cancellation happening were a scalar field coupled derivatively to some other field, and then the Coulomb case. In the Coulomb case, I've gone through the cancellation, showed you that the Coulomb interaction cancels the failure of the two-point function of the photon to be covariant, but have not derived that interaction from using canonical methods yet. That's kind of the next thing. But we'd also seen that there is a cancellation between, for the scalar field, and there was a factor of two that seemed to be going wrong in the canonically derived Lagrangian. So let me just remind you of what the Lagrangian was. I'll tell you what my error was. I think I had a master, I can't remember now. But the important thing was that we had an interaction which was W mu d mu psi for some field W. And you can imagine the W is just another field that we're going to keep track of and somewhere else in the Lagrangian, but that wasn't so important. And then we calculated the canonical momentum was the variation of the action with respect to psi dot. And if we wrote this out, this was 1/2 psi dot squared, time derivative squared, minus 1/2 grad psi squared, minus 1/2 m squared psi squared. And then this was minus w zero psi dot, minus w dot grad psi. And so this was just psi dot plus, or sorry, minus w naught. So that was the new thing that's happening with derivative interactions was that we're starting to change the relationship between the canonical momentum and the velocity. So we could solve this for psi, you know, so everywhere we see psi dot, we were always thinking of it as being pi plus w naught. And then we just follow our nose, and the Hamiltonian density was going to be pi times psi dot minus L. And so went through the exercise and we had, so this was pi plus w naught. And then we had minus 1/2 I plus W naught squared. And we had plus the gradients to all the stuff that doesn't really matter here. minus W naught, pi plus W naught. Sorry, minus, I guess we have plus that. Plus W dot grad psi. Then we grouped all the terms, and it was basically, it was the thing that we had when we didn't have the interaction term. And then there was an interaction piece. And in particular, we were following the W naught squared term, right? And so in the interaction piece was, this is a thing that's linear in W naught, but this is a W naught squared minus a half times it. And we had plus one. So altogether we had plus 1/2 versus H interaction. So what I should have written here is H. And that half was the problem. Because when we did the cancellation before, we were looking at the S matrix. So that's the Hamiltonian. And then we had the S matrix, and it was 1 minus I integral d4x of the interaction Hamiltonian. Then there was a minus I squared over 2 interact d4x d4y of the time ordered product, so w mu of x, w nu of y. Right, as I just say, h of x, time ordered product of h of x, h of y. These are, again, interaction. And when I went through this exercise before, it looked like, so if we wrote this, I should just write this out. So if I write out what this is, I'm going to focus on the W naught squared term. So I'm going to keep this term here. But in here, we also had a piece which was, basically, this term and the linear and pi term was something which is covariant. And so it has the form of W dot grad psi plus
pi W zero.
Thank you. That works, right? There's a plus one, and then these guys cancel. There's a plus one here, and then there's a minus one here, right? So this is kind of morally the W mu grad mu term that we had in the Lagrangian. So when we did the calculation last time, the non-covariance was coming in because, you know, that thing, the way I wrote it last time was minus I squared over 2 integral d4x integral d4y of w mu of x w nu of y times time ordered product of d mu psi of x d mu psi of y. And the statement was that we could write this thing was not covariant. Because it was the thing that was covariant. Here's where I should have probably been using primes here, just because I can just put a prime on the derivative. Minus the extra bits. When we did this derivative, the different derivatives was hitting the step function, and that was giving us non-covariant things, which would have been on this side, but I'm going to subtract them on this side because this is what we have in here already. So we have minus, if this guy hits the step function, we get a delta function of x minus y, x minus x naught prime. And so then if the mu hits the step function, we had a delta mu 0, and then this guy was still hitting psi, so we had d nu psi, time-ordered product of psi of x, d mu psi of x prime. Then the other piece we had was when the other derivative hits it. And the other derivative, we're differentiating, if the step function was x minus y, well, there's a bunch of other terms. I won't write them all down. Plus the other things involving a delta function. And then there was a piece which was where both derivatives act on the delta function. So we had a delta mu 0, delta nu 0, derivative of delta function, x naught minus y naught, times time ordered product of psi of x prime. And the words I said, and this is the wrong part, were, and the reason the wrong part was, I said the wrong part was when I was when I did this for my notes, I didn't do a real scalar field. I did a complex one, and I coupled the current up there. Instead of having W mu d mu psi, it was W mu d mu psi plus psi star. And then I had gone through the exercise in my notes where you did not have a half because it was complex. If you do the same exercise where you have two fields, psi and psi star, and just repeat the process, you'll find that you arrive here with the W naught without the half. And then also down here, we would have had a psi and a psi star. And so then the pieces which are surviving here are different. And so the way I sold it to you, this was giving me twice something, and that two canceled this two, and it was exactly then what we needed to cancel the this term if I had a W naught squared without the half. And that was when we did the cancellation, that's the way it worked. And that's why I was arguing when we did the cancellation that you didn't need the half there. And so the puzzle was, why doesn't the half there screw everything up? And it doesn't, because the logic of which of these things are surviving changes, because they're both psi's, and it's not psi with psi star. And so if you think about, in particular, this one survives. And so what happens is, with this one, if you take an expectation value of something, when you integrate by parts this derivative, at least once it hits this guy. And so that contributes. And when you add up that one and then the ones that are in here, which are also contributing, then they precisely cancel with that factor of a half, is the way it works out. And what happens is that this guy comes in, this guy has the opposite sign. It has they fight each other. So it's like this thing looks like by itself, looks like it has the wrong coefficient to cancel and a half, but this term adds to that term, and then they cancel properly. So it's just a matter of doing the algebra correctly, which I didn't do it on the board correctly. But I verified that it works, but I won't take a chance of doing it now because that's a bad life choice. So there's no magic there. Okay. Good. Any questions about that before we start? So the starting point I wanted to...
In the last lecture, there was a commutation, right, over there, the term which you showed, the last term where you have two delta functions.
Right, because there's various terms where you differentiate you either differentiate the, there's two step functions, one of which is x minus y, one's y minus x. And so
in the last lecture, I guess you mentioned that the commutation is zero because there was psi x and psi x prime, right?
Right, which may or may not have been true. So it's because let me write it out just so we can be not ambiguous. Where did I put that board? Yeah. So if we just write the rest of these terms here, do it. So what we're using is that we've got theta of x naught minus y naught times psi of x prime plus theta of y naught minus x naught. Right. That's y. Psi of y psi of x. And we're focusing on when derivatives act on these guys, right? So this was when, so we have a d mu x prime is y.
Right.
So the d mu hits this guy and gives this term. And then the d mu hits this guy and gives you minus the thing with the opposite order. So we'll have a minus the delta function, which I've written already. And there'll be a delta mu zero psi of x prime, e nu psi of x prime, psi of x. And then there's the same thing for the d nu prime. So that we'll have a d nu prime. I think this one will give us, it'll give us the opposite signs here. So we'll get minus delta nu zero, this delta function times d mu psi of x prime. This is all inside the square bracket here. And then we have a plus d nu zero psi of x prime. Right? And so so these are the commutators we're talking about, right? This one and this one and this one and this one.
Yeah. And then there's a commutation between psi and psi x prime, I guess, when it hits on both the...
No, there's no commutator here, because here the two derivatives hit the delta the step functions, and then there's nothing requiring you to do things twice.
That was, I guess, the...
Yeah. And I might have said words about commutators here, and that was just... Oh, just bullshit. And so, but it, what the actual thing, if you track through where the all the terms that involve W naught squared, undifferentiated, you know, that when you integrate by parts, this is going to hit the W naughts, but it's going to give you things involving W naught derivatives, which you have to then worry about them, how they cancel. But the ones involving no W naughts differentiated, there's a term where this derivative integrates by parts and acts on this guy. And that's the one that is, if you don't have that one, you won't see the cancellation happen. Okay, so now the goal is to repeat that exercise for QED, and so so canonical methods also generate the required non-covariant pieces of H in electromagnetism. I'll reserve QED to be electrons coupled to photons, and we're just talking about the photons here, so I'll just say them. and you remember what that term was the interaction Hamiltonian had a piece in it, which was 1 over 8 pi times the integral d3x of J0 of x, right, D3y, J0 of x. So this is the Hamiltonian density, so I don't have to do one of these integrals. The Hamiltonian will be the integral of this, J0 of y, or x minus y. And this factor here was, that makes, another way of writing this would have been 1 half the electrostatic potential times J0. Because all I'm just doing is using the solution, the electrostatic, you know, del squared A0 is equal to J0, then this is the solution for that with the 4 pi. And so this was a numerical factor we needed to get the cancellation to work. And so I want to show that that is what comes out. And so for that, we have to have the Lagrangian. And then Lagrangian for electromagnetism is just 1 half E squared minus B squared. If you had been doing it in... you know, the EB notation. And then relativistically, that's minus 1/4 F mu nu, F mu nu. And it had to be a Lorentz scalar, so it is, which is good. And so now there's a whole bunch of things that happen, right? Because so now what we want to do is we want to follow our nose, and there's three places where we get hit in the nose when we try and do that. And one of them is, you know, so who's the field? And clearly, it's not going to be E and B, because there's nothing involving time derivatives E and B. And that's reasonable that we should not be thinking of E and B as being the field, because normally when you're doing canonical quantization, the thing you're varying is completely unconstrained. And we know that E and B are satisfying, you know, there's the four Maxwell equations, but two of them, you know, div B equals zero and div E equals J zero. Those don't involve time derivatives. And so those, the way to think about those, if you think about in this Hamiltonian way that we're heading towards, it's all about you have initial data and you're making a set of first order equations that evolve you forward. And then you have to specify the initial positions of all the variables, so the initial values of all the variables you're evolving, and then you're away to the races. And so the evolution equations are always of the form ddt of something is equal to something. Where the somethings on the right-hand side, it doesn't involve time derivatives. And so you can throw that on a computer and you can kind of time step your way forward in time, because if you know the right-hand side, At initial time, you can figure out the derivative, and then you can step forward to see what things look like at a slightly later time. And from that point of view, the two other Maxwell equations that involve time derivatives of E and B are the evolution equations. But these are all happening, they're relating the fields at a specific time. And so these are really constraint equations. They're saying that you're not free to choose initial conditions for B and E arbitrarily, because they have to, at the initial time, satisfy this and this. And so that means they're not free to be arbitrarily varied. And so you should be looking for fields which you can vary arbitrarily. And that's kind of where the vector potential and the electrostatic potential come in. So normally what you then say is that you say that, well, I'll take B to be the curl of A. And that makes this thing true. A is completely arbitrary, and this is just an automatic consequence. So if I vary A through all possible choices of A, this will always be true for B. And then you ask E to be minus, A dot minus grad of the electrostatic potential. And the electrostatic potential works out to be A zero if you wanted to sit in a four vector. So the four vector A upper mu is the electrostatic potential and the vector potential. And when you're in the conventions we have where time is the negative one in the metric, when you lower the time thing, you get a sign. So A zero is minus the electrostatic potential at A. And the way you figure that out is you just take the relationship here, F mu nu is equal to partial mu A nu minus partial nu A mu, and you ask which one gives you these, because these are the ones that come down to us from history. So some of the signs that I'm going to do are going to rely on this. So the your intuition for the electrostatic potential is A upper zero. Okay, so this is what the Maxwell equations say. And they say that if we choose, the point of this is that this makes this true always. And this says that this will be true always because the...
I think you derived that from the grad, the curl of E.
Yeah, it's the curl equation that does that, right? Yeah.
So Faraday's law.
Right. So this is not the statement I'm going to make is true, but the reason I was going to give for making it isn't true. So the claim is that if I vary A0 and the three vector A arbitrarily, then I'm exploring all of the allowed pieces of E space. But it is true that this is not an identity. It's just telling us something about these fields. And I'm going to leave this up here because we're going to use that in a second. So that means that when I think of this, what I should do is I should be thinking of L as being the variables that L is a function of aren't E and B. It's really A0 and A in principle. So if I wrote that out, I won't write it out separately, but we're supposed to think of these things as being code for these things. And so now we can kind of follow our nose and ask, what's the canonical momentum? And that's where we start hitting problems, right? So if we ask, what's the canonical momentum for A the vector, so pi, that'll be A dot. Well, A dot is appearing here, and so that means it's in here. So when we differentiate this, we're going to get pulled down to 2, and we'll get E dot, the variation of E. The variation of E is minus the variation of A dot. So what we're going to do is the derivative will be minus E. That shows you that the electric field is basically the canonical momentum up to a sign. But the problematic one is A0, right? If we ask for pi 0 to be delta A0 dot, that's just 0. Because A0 is never differentiated with respect to time here because F is always antisymmetric. If I make that a 0, this will never be a 0 here. And so that's, we alluded to this before, that's the sign that you have a constraint, because what we're supposed to have done is we're supposed to have taken the momentum as a function of psi dot and then solve that for psi dot as a function of momentum. And then we'd like to make the Lagrangian, the Hamiltonian from pi psi dot minus the Lagrangian, where we take the psi dots and trade them for pi's for momenta. And that's going to fail here because there's no way to solve for A0 in terms of pi naught. So that's kind of that's a constraint. It's singular in the sense that we cannot solve for a zero dot equals a function of stuff. At the classical level, that's already a problem. At the quantum level, it's going to have to be a problem too, because naively what we're going to be doing is we're going to be asking the basic fields and their canonical momenta to fail to commute up to a delta function. And if one of the canonical momenta is zero, it can't fail to commute with anything. It's the zero operator. And so there's two levels of problem here. And in this one, and they're both basically solved problems. So the theory of constrained Hamiltonian systems is how you deal with these systematically. And that was done by Dirac, I think, in the 1950s. It was quite late, comparatively late. You know, no reason why someone couldn't have done this in the 19th century. And it's in the Canadian Journal of Mathematics, of all places. and there's good reviews. And the one I mentioned the other day was by and Teitelboim. There might be an X there, I forget now. But for electromagnetism, that's overkill. The problem, we're going to be able to deal with this constraint in a way which is kind of more straightforward. And the reason is that these equations are all going to be linear, and so it's possible to be very explicit about how to solve the constraints. And if you can solve the constraints explicitly like we're going to, then that formalism is not different. It's just a more general way of phrasing things, which is useful when you can't solve constraints explicitly, which is the case of interest in non-abelian gauge theories or gravity and stuff like that. But in this case, the lesson here is that pi zero is constrained and a zero is not a dynamical variable. A zero dot doesn't appear anywhere. So we should think of it as being a function of the other variables. It's a derived quantity. And so what we'll do is, we'll use this, we combine those. That's saying that minus div dot a dot. Right. If I, the divergence of this has a term in it. If things had been time independent and that wasn't there, then the divergence of this would have been the Laplacian of this, and then that would have led us to Poisson's equation where del squared a zero is given by j zero. More generally, this is there, but we're solving a differential equation where we're taking derivatives of a and a zero, and then the right-hand side is independent of them. So it's an inhomogeneous equation. And the general solution to that kind of equation is to take a particular solution and then add to it a solution to the homogeneous equation where there's nothing on the right-hand side. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to split e into what I'll call the homogeneous part, which is basically this. And this guy, I'm going to just define to be the thing that satisfies this. Whereas this guy will satisfy the divergence of this is zero. So it's like the radiation part of the field. And this will be the piece, the Coulomb part of the field that's just dictated by wherever the charges are. The strategy is we'll just treat a zero as an explicit function of the other degrees of freedom. In this case, the other degrees of freedom aren't the A's, it's the charges or whatever other things were that were generating J0. And those will be, those will be things that you will quantize. And then the commutation relation that a zero satisfies, it'll inherit because it'll be a function of those other guys and they will have some quantization relationship. And the way we're going to solve it is we're going to ask minus del squared a zero to be j zero. And then that's the one whose solution is the Coulomb one that I've put behind the other board here. That means that a zero is 1 over 4 pi integral. This is a zero of x and t would be d3y I was just taking the Green's function for del squared, and that's because it's linear, we can be explicit about what the solution is. And once we've done that, what we'll do is we'll define the rest of E. That'd be minus A dot, and that satisfies the divergence of E is zero. Because the full electric field is that plus this, and we've arranged this to satisfy this already. And kind of morally, physically, this is the radiation part of the field. It's the thing that could be there independent of whether or not you had sources or not. So if we do that, then we're kind of almost away to the races. So it's but for the we are away to the races for the Hamiltonians, and now we just have to follow our nose. So we know if it's up there now, I'll rewrite it. So we know that L is a 1/2. Let's write this out now, right? So E is the homogeneous guy minus grad of A naught squared minus B squared . So we follow our noses, and we're thinking of the independent variables being the vector potential A, and then possibly we could have had some matter fields. Just call them collectively psi. Don't really care what they are. And then we should have a coupling between them. So we should have something which gives us a current. And here I'm going to take the coupling to be linear in A, just that's because that's where we're headed for is quantum electrodynamics, where that's actually true. And so we'll imagine there's L interaction, and L interaction, what I mean by that is there'll be a plus, and here there's a sign here, J mu plus or minus J mu. This is a pure convention, so it's sorry, this is not meant to take this long. I just misplaced my page here. Here we go. Minus. I just want to have the convention for J zero being J upper zero. I want it to be the electric charge density. So the analog of this will be that J zero, J upper mu will be electric charge density and then the electric current density. Good. So now we just do what we're supposed to do. So the canonical momentum and the variables that we're thinking of, the canonical degrees of freedom, are the vector potential and these matter ones. So we'll have pi will be delta action delta A dot. And we know already that that's going to be just minus, they're all in here, so it'll be minus E homogeneous. And so because we know that E homogeneous satisfies that, we also know that pi satisfies that. And I'll come back to that later on. And then for the matter fields, let me call P will be the derivative of the action with respect to any matter fields. And I'm not going to care much about what those are, because the first goal is to find the Hamiltonian. So what we'll do is we take the Hamiltonian density, and it's going to be the vector potential dot A dot plus, say, P times psi dot. And there might be more than one of these. So maybe we should imagine we have some label A, which labels all the various other fields. Then we subtract the Lagrangian. And what we know is going to is that this guy with this guy is going to become the Hamiltonian of the matter sector. That'll be H matter. That's this and that. And we want to focus on the E and M part of it. So the E and M part of it is going to be, so we have pi is this minus E. So I'll write that as minus E. And then A dot we know is given by, again, minus E home. So we're going to get plus E home squared. That's this term. Then we have to subtract the Lagrangian. So we have minus 1 half E home squared minus grad A0 squared plus 1 half B squared. And then here we have, this is, you know, minus J0 A0 minus J dot A. And if I'm taking, we have to decide who our basic variable is, just to keep track of the sign. Since I've kept track of it, of the A upper zeros, let's write this as plus A0 A0 A0. And so when we subtract that, we're going to get minus J0 A0 plus J dot A. And I think I've got everything there, right? That's that one, that one, that one. So the usual thing that happens for the E squareds is going to be we're going to get one here, minus half there. So that'll be do what it was supposed to do. So we're going to get H matter. And then we're going to get 1 half E homogeneous squared plus B squared. And that's what the energy density would have been for an electromagnetic field, right? If you just had calculated classically what the energy of a field would have been, it's E squared plus B squared. And then we want to keep track of these other guys here. So we have plus J dot A. We have minus J zero A zero. And then here we've got, there's a cross term here, which is E dot grad A. And in the total Hamiltonian, we're going to integrate this over space. So the Hamiltonian will contain a term, which is the integral d3x of E homogeneous dot grad of A0 with a, there's a minus sign, another minus sign. The twos will cancel, so it'll just be this. But this is, because this is true, I can equally well write this as being, this is the divergence of E home times A0. So this is a something which it's a total derivative, and so it just depends on the things in the boundaries, and so it's not contributing to any of the energies internal, this stuff. So I can throw that term away. So that's a total derivative. And then all that will survive then is this guy. So we'll have a minus a half grad A0 squared, and that's it. And since we're throwing total derivatives away, we can integrate this one by parts and make it a plus, you know, A0 del squared A0. And then we know that del squared A0 is, del squared A0 is minus J0. So this is minus a half A0 J0. And there's a sign that went askew. There's always a sign that goes wrong. And that's why I was trying to be... The where I would have I've introduced a random sign is that if we've got this to be the equation of motion, that should follow from the equations of motion from this. And so this choice of sign here dictates whether or not we get a plus J0 or minus J0. So I probably got that wrong. So let's just do that. So if I take the, if all I had was L was, let's just focus on the electrostatic piece. It would have been 1 half grad A0 squared. That's this term. And then over here, I've got a plus J0 A0. So if I vary A0 to get the equation of motion, so if I take delta action, delta A0 equals zero, I'm going to integrate by parts, and I'll get a minus del squared A0 plus J0 equals zero. And so that's the wrong sign. I made the wrong choice because it should have been minus del squared is equal to plus J0. So that means that this should have been a plus, this should have been a minus, plus, minus, minus, plus. This one doesn't change because it came from the from that term. And so now what we have is minus J, or plus J0 A0 minus a half J0 A0. So altogether, this whole thing is grouping into plus a half A0 J0. And if I put in what A0 is there, this is the 1 over 8 pi integral d3y of J0 of x, J0 of y. And so that's got exactly the, that a half is the one that makes this a 1 over 8 pi rather than 4 pi, which is exactly what we needed to make all the cancellations work. So the lesson is that the non-covariant Coulomb piece is doing what it's supposed to do to, it's being generated with the right numerical coefficient to take out the non-covariant pieces of the propagator A mu, A nu.
Hey, Cliff.
Yeah.
Did you move to the other side of that board? Because the camera seems to be stuck on the empty one here.
Oh, it's over here?
Oh, yeah, all right. It's been on this board for a while, so I can't see all the sign changes.
Okay, so which board would you like to see of what's already written that you can't see now? I think that they're responding with the camera now. So tell us what board to point to.
The one you're standing in front of now.
This one here, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, good. So the upshot, what we're talking about was the thing in the box here, is that the sign that I had chosen incorrectly was I chose L interaction to be minus this. But the check on that is I should be getting this equation as the equation of motion for A0. This is Gauss's law. The div E is equal to rho. And I had done the wrong one. So the sign we really want is the plus sign here. So the bottom line is that we're getting the second example where the canonical methods are just giving you what you need for the non-covariant parts of the Hamiltonian.
So the non-covariant part is 1 half A naught J naught?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
So could I understand? So we're treating A0 as a function of the others.
Yeah.
Actually means we have added it as a constraint and treated it as a Lagrange multiplier, but then solved this part.
Right.
So, and reinserted it into the Lagrangian again. So in some sense, this Lagrangian where A0 is a function of the others is already a reduced one, right?
Yes. Right. So there's a series of constraints in electromagnetism, and one of them you can just do this way because it's you can just solve it. There's still a constraint that I'm about to talk about now that it's still there, and it's to do with this. Yeah, that's relating the momenta at a given time, and so that means that it doesn't change this discussion of the Hamiltonian. But when we go to quantizing the system, we want to, naively what we would do now, I'm going over to the far board here. Can you see the board, Liam? Okay.
He sees the middle one.
Yeah, I'm hoping that by asking him that the person watching, yeah, will notice. Thank you. So the other constraint to worry about is the quantization condition. If the rule is, if we're kind of using this as the way we're going to quantize things, then what we would normally do is we would ask, the positions and the momenta to be equal to I times the delta function, right? And I always have to do this. So this is like x times minus I derivative minus the other one is plus I, is that's right, yeah. So this is what we normally would ask. And so for fields where A actually includes the position label, we would normally we'll write this as say psi of x and t. These are at the same time with the canonical momentum, y of t. That would have been I times delta function of x minus y in field space, if we're doing a scalar field or something. So naively, what we should be doing in this electromagnetic case is we should be taking, you know, ai of x and t with pi j of y and t. So the same t is I times delta ij times delta of x minus y. And that can't be right because it's not consistent with this. If I take the divergence of this side of the equation, I should get zero, but the divergence of that side of the equation is not zero. And so this is another particularly simple constraint. You know, this constraint is relating the momenta at a given time, but it's, again, a linear constraint. So it has the, if we had a bunch of variables like x, and I had said there's some constraint that CA PA is equal to zero for some, you know, mechanical system, then you kind of know what you're supposed to do is that you'd like to have them fail to commute with unit weight, but this is just saying that really part of your space isn't really playing any role because it's the constraint is saying that your perpendicular, your momenta are always perpendicular to some vector. And so the thing that you should be doing here, if you have a constraint like this, is you want this to be true in the space that's perpendicular to that vector. And so you want this but you want it to be consistent with the constraint. If I hit this thing with C, I have to get zero. So what you want to have appear here is not delta AB. You'd want to have the projection matrix P, or everything's a P, curly P. Let's call it lambda. I've used lambda already. Say MAB, where M is just, you know, 1 minus C, C transpose. So it's you know, MAB is delta AB minus CA CB. All that's doing is it's, you know, you've got coordinates that are badly adapted to your constraint. If you'd kind of arranged things so that you were, all your coordinates were perpendicular to that vector, then this would be true. This, using a projection matrix here, will make, for all the degrees of freedom that matter, will make it true that X with P is just the unit matrix. But by using a projection matrix, you're making it also consistent with if I contract this with a C, I have to contract this with a C, and this is designed so that C acting on this is going to cancel because I'll get a C squared, whoops. C here has to be a unit vector for what I wrote here. If C transpose C equals 1, otherwise you have to divide by the norm of C. But this is just defined to be, it's a projection matrix in the sense that M squared is equal to M, and so its eigenvalues are 0 and 1. So there's always a basis which you can write it as being a unit matrix, and then zeros where you've projected out what the components are. So what we'll have to do is have we need the projection matrix, which is orthogonal to gradient, and that's easy enough to do. So it's going to be, what we should do here is we should be writing minus, you know, grad I, grad j over del squared. And that's the unit matrix for things that are orthogonal to the gradient. And in momentum space, these would have turned into pi, pj over p squareds. And so if you go back and take the, you know, when we started the whole course off, we had a mu was coming. I argued that the symmetries of Lorentz symmetries were giving us sum over helicities, integral d3p, you know, the square root of 2 pi cubed times twice the energy as a function of p. And I said there's a polarization vector, p lambda, p to the I, p dot x, times a destruction operator, p lambda, and we know that these A's satisfy, you know, the particle destruction, you know, delta of p minus q, delta sigma lambda, or zeta lambda. If I just take this, which is what Lorentz invariance was telling us, we had to take a mu to b with these things were defined, you remember, to be in the special frame in the frame where p moves along the z-axis, these were two basis vectors in the xy plane. And so when we boosted to a general frame, that took us to an epsilon which satisfies that P mu epsilon mu was equal to zero always. And so that meant that, and it's in particular, if we're doing things non-relativistically, this has no component in the time direction. And so this is basically the saying that the three momentum dot these polarization vectors is zero. This thing is by construction satisfying grad, you know, div A equals zero. And so if we calculate what E is using this, we would find that it satisfies this. So that's implying that the divergence of pi is equal to zero. And so this field that we're getting, if we take its commutation relations using this as the thing that we're given, which is what we would have done if we started from a theory of photons, we would just arrive at this without having to do anything. And we would have done that because when we did the commutation relation of these two A's, we would have ended up with a sum over lambda of these polarization vectors, and those polarization vectors would have given us this factor because it had to be perpendicular to the momentum. So canonical, so the point of this exercise is that this canonical, here's another constraint. It complicates how you do the quantizations. In this case, it's because it's such a simple constraint, you can again be explicit in how you deal with it, like because you can explicitly write the projection matrix that satisfies the constraint. And so again, it leads you, when you follow your canonical nose, to a commutation relation, which, see now, if we had taken the canonical quantization point of view, we would have said, this is the thing we're given. And if we had then written this, we would derive what these A's do. And then this would then imply that this is true, given that the polarization vectors are what they are. And so, and that also relied on this factor of two being here. The fact that you're getting one when you have a factor of I here is what this conventional normalization is all about. So the message is that the canonical quantization for electromagnetism, although it has some wrinkles in it, is giving you the same information that the representation theory did for the electromagnetic field, with these caveats being that that's a true statement, but you might be surprised by the way your commutation relations look, and you might have been surprised if you weren't expecting it that the interactions are looking non-covariant. But that's exactly what you need to make things come out right. Yeah, good. It's 11 o'clock. So now for the natural place that this goes is, so this is nice. You don't have to guess what the non-canonical Hamiltonian is, but you still have to use it, right? And that's a pain. And for some questions, that's just life. If you want to know what the energy is of the helium atom, you need to know the Coulomb interaction exists. And so, you know, the matrix element you'd take of the Hamiltonian would be this operator where you're plugging in these fields. And so just following your nose with quantum mechanics with this Hamiltonian will give you the right answer because these pieces of the interaction are there. But if you're calculating something like scattering or something, it's a pain because at any intermediate step along the way, it's not going to be obvious that things are Lorentz invariant because you've got all these weird cancellations going on. And the whole point of this, of writing things in terms of time ordered products of fields was that once you had the particles and the antiparticles, so you'd built in that the Hamiltonian was commuting at space-like separations, the way that perturbation came to you was as a time-ordered product of Hamiltonians, and then the Hamiltonian was being built from the fields. So when you stuck this in, you ended up getting a bunch of time-ordered products of the fields. And the time-ordered product of the field was something which was explicitly covariant. And although it was true that if I take one particular ordering where this is later than this, I get something which is not covariant. If I just take if I write this as theta of x naught minus y naught, then do this matrix element. So I take the vacuum with a p a star q vacuum. I take those terms in the expansion of these fields. I read off the coefficient, I would have gotten, you know, interval d3p over 2 pi cubed twice the energy of p e to the I p dot x for a scalar field. I think I've done that right. That that. There's nothing wrong with that. The thing I'm going to say is, we would have had a similar term coming from the other ordering where we change x with y. So this is x minus y. We have integral d3p, 2 pi cubed, twice the energy, minus ip x minus y. You know, if you go through this, the steps where you take the step functions and you write them as a Fourier space, and so you end up with an energy, you end up with an energy denominator from that that rewriting of the step function. This whole thing combines into the usual covariant propagator, which is, you know, minus I over 2 pi to the fourth integral d4q, if you like, of e to the I q x minus y over q squared plus m squared. Like q mu plus m squared minus I epsilon. I mentioned this last class, and I think you've probably seen this before in your introductory courses. You know, the I epsilon comes from the representation of the step function. Remember, x naught minus y naught e to the I omega t, and there's a sign here I always get wrong. So there's a correlated sign here and here, which is not important for what I'm about to say. But this is the thing that would have going to turn out to be epsilon. The message I have is that the things that are these two terms in Fourier space, once you've replaced the step function, they don't look very covariant. And that's because one of them is describing, you create the particle, you know, if this has been a complex field, so these have been particles versus antiparticles. This is the thing that creates the particle, but the other term in the other order is creating the antiparticle. So this term would have come from, you know, vacuum antiparticle P, antiparticle creation Q. And so it's each of them separately, because of these linear things involving the frequency, don't look very covariant. But when you combine them together, you know, this kind of an energy denominator is what you would have, and you normally expect to see that in perturbation theory in ordinary old-fashioned Rayleigh-Schrodinger quantum mechanics. That's what these things are. And the but Rayleigh-Schrodinger quantum mechanics doesn't look very covariant, but it's becoming covariant when you add the particle and the antiparticle interchange. So the particle going from x to y and the antiparticle going from y to x, the sum of those things is manifestly covariant, and that's what's making perturbation theory look so covariant once you've made this thing commute at space-like separations. And now we're back in the soup, because that whole development, which took, you know, decades to do, was making it kind of manifestly obvious at every step along the way that you were Lorentz covariant. And now we've got to have this weird cancellation going on between various terms. You can imagine if you actually had to do this when you're doing calculations that are all complicated, you're never going to get it right. So the best way to derive in practice relativistic perturbation theory is to not deal with these Hamiltonians and to go right to the Lagrangian. And that's what the path integral is for. And so the motivation for canonical quantization is that it gives you, from the relativistic perspective, is that it gives you the right non-covariant Hamiltonians to make everything work. But the motivation for the path integral is that you don't have to talk about Hamiltonians, and so that you can just basically phrase, if you're doing scattering problems where you're not trying to ask the energy of the state, so the Hamiltonian isn't really primitive to what you're trying to do, the path integral is the most efficient way to organize that, because the path integral is constructed to just use the Lagrangian, and the Lagrangian is beautiful. The Hamiltonian is you know, only a mother could love it, but the Lagrangian, it's the thing that's manifestly Lorentz invariant. It's really the thing you want to use. And so at this point is a natural place to ask, who of you have seen path integrals? So sounds like you've seen it, and it's probably one of those things where, you know, it's like many things, you learn them in the streets, right? So you don't know if you're doing it right. But and that's good enough for what we're going to do. There is a nice discussion of, I'll see if I can track down. I remember Weinberg, I think in his book, does a nice discussion. And one of the things that's nice about the discussion about path integrals, the way he does it, is that these I epsilons, there's another way of thinking with them. In a path integral, one way of thinking with those I epsilons is that they're coming from the wave function of the vacuum in the initial and final times. And that's, I'm not going to do that here, but you should know that it exists. And I'm pretty sure it's in Weinberg volume 1 or 2. So what I'm going to do, since you've seen the definitions, I'm just going to write it, because it's the usual thing that the algorithm is actually really simple. And when you're doing Feynman rules and looking at scattering processes, the path integral is just makes all of this stuff just pale by comparison with the ease of use, because you know the basic statement about path integrals. So the point of them is for us, for at least here, is they allow S to be not just S, but also correlation functions, you know, allow calculations to be done explicitly using only L for which Lorentz invariance is manifest. So all these kind of weird cancellations will just be, you know, be all behind the board, and you don't have to worry about them anymore. And so, so the starting thought, which I think you've seen before, is that if we had had a quantum mechanical system, like not field theory, if we just had, you know, a bunch of positions qi or say qa of time, and some momenta for them, pa of time, and a Hamiltonian for them, each of the p's and the q's. Then the basic statement of the path integral would have been that if you had prepared a field to be at a position, you know, an eigenstate of Q at a specific time, and then you evolved it forward to a later time and asked what's the likelihood that it's in a different eigenstate of Q, so you calculate the matrix element. Say, let me call this X because I'm going to be wanting to call that X. Let's just call it X. I calculate the matrix element to be at position X at time t, given that I was originally at I'll evolve it. I calculate that e to the minus I. Or, and I started off, let's say, I'll end at y, let's say, at time, and I'll start off at x at time t naught. So that would have been, in Schrodinger picture, it would have been the y x matrix element of e to the minus I h t minus t naught. So that's the thing you're often trying to calculate. And if you know what this is, I'm not going to write these indices anymore either, then you can figure out anything else. If you have some other state here and some other state here, then what you'll just do is you'll multiply by the wave functions of those states and then integrate over x and y. So if you know that, then you can figure out, you know, psi t phi t naught, because that will just, I'll just take the wave function that corresponds to psi. Let me use psi. I'm going to have too many things looking like Greeks. So let's just say it was a momentum eigenstate, and say this was an energy eigenstate. Then I'll just take the momentum wave function of y, and I'll take the energy wave function at x, and I'll take this thing that we just calculated, h of t minus t naught. And then I just do the integral, you know, dx, dy. So anything you want to do in this kind of evolution picture, this is not going to give you things where these things are both at the same time, but it's giving you something at a later time. Involves, if you can figure this out, then you're in business for figuring anything else out. And then the statement about the path integral is that this is equal to the sum over the paths, you know, x of t, of e to the I action. So that e to the I integral, you know, dt of the Lagrangian. And the boundary condition, so you're summing over all paths, that's what the curly D means. But the boundary condition is that they're all paths which start and end at the same place. So they satisfy, if I write this as integral from x to y, x from x at t0 to y at t, what that means is that these paths, every path in your integral, or x, let me in the integral call it, I'll call it q, the variable, the dummy variable in the integral, qa. So qa of t0 will always be equal to x, the thing that you started off with, and qa of t will always be equal to y. You're summing over all the paths. For any given path, you evaluate the action, and then you add up all the answers, and it's, you know, it's a hugely ill-defined thing to do, and you figure out how to make that sense, then make sense of it, and that's giving you the right amplitude. And the beauty of it is it involves the Lagrangian. And in practice, since we're going to be doing perturbation theory, you know, in real life it's hard to do those integrals, but in practice, in perturbation theory, it's easy to do the integrals because all you're ever doing are Gaussian integrals. Because in perturbation theory, by which I'm going to mean semi-classical perturbation theory, what we're going to do is we'll take the action, which is this integral, you know, that's what this is, right? And we're going to write it as being, it's an integral of the Lagrangian. But we'll write the Lagrangian as being, we'll take all our paths and we'll write them as being QA of T is equal to some classical path, you know, Q classical A of T plus delta Q A. And then in our Lagrangian, we're going to write that as, we'll just do an expansion. And the first term in this thing is going to be zero because our background will solve the classical equations. So our action will be something not involving these fluctuations, something that's linear in these fluctuations, which will be zero because that's how you're choosing this guy, something quadratic in the fluctuations, plus something cubic in the fluctuations, and so on. And then what we do is we take the e to the I action. Let me change boards. You write e to the I action as being e to the I s naught plus I s2, and then everything else you expand out. So it's a 1 plus I s3 plus s4 plus, you know, I squared over 2 s3 plus s4 plus squared. So you're just taking the exponential and just doing the series for the exponential. And when you do that, in the end of the day, all the integrals you're doing, so you're in the integral over dq, you're really in the different paths are all the different choices for delta q. And the integral has the structure of, so the integral dq of e to the I s has the structure of integral d delta q of e to the I. You can take the e to the I s naught out front because it doesn't depend on delta q. And we have e to the I s2, which is basically has the structure of delta q, some operator delta q, integrated over time. And then we have 1 plus polynomials in delta q. So all you ever have to do is an integral of some products of delta q weighted by Gaussian. And the general answer to that is known, right? So if you, so the integral of x integral, you know, dnx of e to the I over 2 x transpose matrix x, you know, xi1, xin, you know what that is once and for all. And it's 0 if n is odd. And if n is even, then it's basically, it's equal to the determinant of m to the minus 1 half times, for all possible pairs of these x's, you insert an m inverse. So it's m inverse I1, I2 times m inverse. I've done this classic mistake of starting in the middle of the board, and let me just start this on the left of the board so you can see the whole thing. So the integral dn x of e to the minus, what I'm going to write down is the one that you would have had if you didn't have, it wasn't complex, but we'll come back to that. That's the determinant of m to the minus a half. Oh, sorry, I forgot the other stuff. It's xi1, xin, 0 if n is odd. And otherwise, if it's even, it's the determinant of m minus 1 half of m inverse I1, I2, M inverse, I3, I4, M inverse, IN minus 1, IN, That's all the permutations. So all the different ways in which you could take pairs of indices, you can write that as an M inverse, and that's what you're going to get for this integral, because it's just a Gaussian integral. And this is what the Feynman rules are, right? This is the Feynman rules in operator language would have been, we go through, we have this S matrix thing, we're doing some time-ordered product of the Hamiltonian, we have a bunch of fields here, all the fields are written in terms of creation and destruction operators. We got some state on the left, some state on the right, which is some particle states which we get from the vacuum by acting with creation destruction operators. And then we know that if we have, in the end of the day, we've got a vacuum on both sides, some initial and final particles that are being created and destroyed, and then this stuff in the middle, you're always taking a bunch of A stars from the initial state, a bunch of A's for the final state, and then a bunch of fields in the middle. You're just asking, if I create a particle, it has to be destroyed somewhere. So you're looking for pairs of A stars and A's where you can end up where all the particles created got destroyed, because that's the only way to get something non-zero. Otherwise, you have states that are orthogonal and you get zero. And so it's the whole story is pairings, where if you pair a field with a guy here, you pick off the coefficient in the field expansion. So if I had phi of x is, you know, integral d3p, some factors e to the I px, you know, a plus other terms. All these coefficients here are being picked off when I hit a star with a, but not here because it was an initial state. I take an a and an a star in here, or the other way around, then I get one for each of these factors. And the time ordering gives me the propagator, which is that combination that we're talking about here. And so the whole story of Feynman rules is just reading off who's the coefficient of A and A star and taking all possible ways in which the A's and A stars could have paired off to destroy and create the particles. That same language is here. But now all it is you're taking all the things that were appearing, which are the fields, and you're getting the fields because in your evolution equation, which I've, in your evolution equation, you know, you've got a Lagrangian which has pieces which are more than quadratic in the fields, and you're doing some path integral, and that's giving you the matrix elements you really wanted. And so, in the end of the day, in perturbation theory, you're doing this kind of an integral over and over again. And the only thing that survives is when you pair things off. And then the rule is you're supposed to take the thing that's appearing here and invert it and connect it up for all the labels you have. So for fields, these I's will turn into positions, and these X's will turn into fields. And it's the same operation, right? You're just keeping track of all the various permutations, the ways in which you can contract things and get something which survives. But this is much easier because every term here is going to want to look covariant because they came from the Lagrangian. The Lagrangian, you know, this will be, if we had taken our Lagrangian to be d mu phi, d mu phi over 2, if I integrate that by parts to write it as being something times something times something, that would be the same as minus that. It'll be plus 1/2 phi, you know, box phi. And if we had a minus 1/2 m squared phi squared, now we're going to have box minus m squared phi. And so you're always looking for the inversions of these operators, which are the Green's functions, to the propagators. And so but they're going to be covariant because these are covariant. And so this way of doing it is just going to hand you things which are covariant. And you don't have to keep track of the Hamiltonian because all that mattered here was the Lagrangian interaction. And so the expression that you're led to, or the S matrix, the punchline, it's as if all sorts of magic happened.
So the operator in the middle, there, box plus m squared, that's going to play the role of m in this?
Yes, right. So for any particular field, you'd have to see what's that operator that's describing your quadratic particle action, and that's the one you're going to want to invert.
Right. I'm having a hard time understanding what these indices you've written here are.
Oh, so let me write a field example, because so for example, so if I did an integral over a field, so for fields where I had something like QA of time, these are all the degrees of freedom we had, and these are the number of independent ones we had. So in a field theory, what's happening is that these are the fields, and the amongst the labels are points in space. So that this would be, this would go over to, you know, you have some kinds of fields, maybe you've got more than one field, but now this is a discrete label, and then, but it's at different positions in time. And so N and X are what was A or I. Over there I used I rather than A, but it's the, so the way you should read the conversion from quantum mechanics to field theory is that you just have a shitload of labels, and it's, but and that includes position. So the translation of that formula would be that I'd have some integral over phi of x in time. So I'm you know, of e to the I action of phi, where the boundary condition would be, you know, if I was, so the translation of the matrix element would be, so what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to translate that statement about x, it's taking the transition from x to y between two times as a path integral. If I wrote that in field space, it would be, I ask, what's the likelihood of starting off, ending up with a configuration phi of x, so some specific configuration. And there's an infinite number of kinds of configurations you could have had, but you choose one, and that's the eigenstate of your state under the field operator. So phi hat of x acting on the state phi, I'll just put a dot there because it depends on something, but it's not the same x necessarily, will be equal to phi of x. So that would be like the position eigenstate, right? And this, for every point, I've given you a value for phi explicitly as a number. And that's what I have to specify for these states. And so then if I said that I had this state at a time t, and I have some different configuration, let's say call it psi of, let me just write dot here because I want to emphasize that you shouldn't read this as a function of x. It's a, you give me a configuration, the whole thing, and I stick it in here, t naught. That will be equal to this path integral. I'll put the boundary conditions in a second of d phi of e to the I action. And the action now is going to be an integral d4x of the Lagrangian density. And the path, the paths we're looking at are paths phi of x and t, which have the property that phi of x and t zero is equal to, it's equal to psi of x, and phi of x and t is equal to curly phi, which is what I call that one, of x. So this is the analog of what I called x over there, this is what I called y, and this is the q that I was doing the integral over. And that's because that's what I specified in the state. So these two things are configurations that you've chosen, and you've chosen the state to be an eigenstate of them. So maybe it's sine x or something, some specific configuration. And then the likelihood of going from here to here is given by the same thing. And if you had put in a generalization of this formula, would have been, you know, if I just leave the t and t naught implicit, so the evolution operator is there. If I put in a bunch of fields here, like phi x of y, or say z of t1, psi hat of say z1, t1, zn, tn, then I would have had a path integral. If it's the same path integral argument would have given me, I would have had in here phi of z1, t1, phi of zn, tn. And the statement is that if this path integral, if you're careful about how the paths go, it actually is giving you the time-ordered product here. And it's not actually really the time-ordered product. It's what I call the T-star product, because if I differentiate this, the derivative goes right in here and hits these guys. And so the derivative goes right past the time ordering. And that's the thing that was the time ordering with all the non-covariant bits thrown away. So the idea is that this is something which looks explicitly covariant, because everybody's, you know, covariant as hell. And so the things, when you set up perturbation theory this way, you know, you'll take your Lagrangian and write it in powers of the field expanded around some classical background field, keep the quadratic part here, expand in all the interactions that are here, and then now the different ways in which, so if I write L as being, you know, L0 plus L1, which goes away because of the classical equations of motion, because I've written phi as a background value plus a fluctuation. And I'm counting the powers of the fluctuation. Then this is the thing that we leave in the exponent, And this is the thing we always write as, you know, one plus stuff. And then when you look at all these contractions, so if you use this rule here, so the rule, the analog of this rule would now be the integral of, you know, d phi of e to the minus, okay, 1/2 integral d4x of phi operator phi. Say we did this one, phi of x t phi of y tau. That integral would be the determinant of this operator delta to the minus 1/2 times the delta inverse as a function of x and y. And that what this really is the Green's function, right? This is the Green's function, x and y. And this determinant, what you should be doing is you think of this, I take this operator, I act on it in some mode functions, and I try and find the eigenfunctions for the operator. And I should think of this determinant as being the product over all the eigenvalues. So that's how you would do it if you were going to be explicit and put it on a computer or something. And I've been lax about the I here. And there's a story about the I. The main one is that in the end of the day, there's a series of related choices. But the Green's function is not unique, right? You could have a retarded Green's function, you could have an advanced Green's function, you could have a Feynman Green's function. And that choice is being made in the operator language with these I epsilons. If I've written that down, if I still have that board. I don't have that board. And the thing that I'm alluding to in the Weinberg book is what you're really normally interested in is not field-to-field transitions. You're normally interested in vacuum, at t goes to infinity, e to the minus I h t minus t naught, or say basically S matrix, vacuum t goes to minus infinity. And so what you have to do in this, you'd calculate this, then you take the wave functional of the vacuum and you'd integrate against that wave functional as a function of phi, you'd integrate over phi. And you take the wave functional initially and you'd integrate over phi. And the wave functional in a free theory is a Gaussian in the fields, which you can explicitly calculate. And if you track that through, those wave functionals turn into the I epsilon prescription for the propagator and they tell you to take the Feynman propagator. And so so behind the board, this time ordering is coming to you because if you did the vacuum to vacuum transition, that's the thing you're led to, which I wasn't going to go through. It's kind of it's one of those things where that's a class in itself, and I could come back to that later on if people decide that's what they want to know. That could be what we do, but the main message is, practice. When I'm going to do Feynman graphs with QED, it's simple to figure out what it will be simple in the examples to read off what the Feynman rules are, because all we're going to do is we're going to take the QED Lagrangian in here, E squared minus B squared, and it'll be coupling. So the thing that'll appear here will be, J mu A mu, where J will probably be quadratic in some fields. And then when we write out these, something like an S matrix element, we'll write it in this path integral way because the evolution equation will have this e to the I action in it. And then it's just a matter of picking off all the various combinations of the fields, finding the inverse of the operator that goes with them. So the Green's function, the Feynman-Green's function, and just writing down the factors. And the only thing that's all tricky then is the combinatorial factors, because when I said here, the permutations, there's often many different ways to give you the same answer. So you want to count those properly, and that's the subtle part. And when you have fermions, there's signs that you have to be careful about. But it's kind of thing where it's not rocket science. You just have to be a good accountant. And if you're ever worried about it, go back to the path integral and say, well, what would I have done if I was just trying to just do the stupid thing doing this Gaussian integral? And you can read them all off. Okay, yeah.
So all these calculations where I find the equivalence between path integrals before and after a transformation. I'm always confused that people somehow tend to assume that the action or the symmetries of the action are the same as the symmetries of the measure. So is this really checked, or is the measure just said to be, well,
it's you have to check it. You have to check it, yeah, because there are some cases where you can't make it invariant, but those are with anomalies that it you have to check it. And so the assumption is that when you choose those, you know, in principle, the way you define, since it's only Gaussian integrals, what you do is you define the phi to be the product over all these, you know, if you had these eigenfunctions here, and if you wrote the fields as expansions in terms of those eigenfunctions with coefficients A, then what you're doing here is you're expanding, you know, you're doing an integral over the coefficients. And that means that the symmetry statement would be, you say, well, how do symmetries act on these mode functions? And then the hope would be that the action of the symmetries on these mode functions would be some matrix. If it was so simple as being some matrix whose determinant was one or something, then you could actually show that the measure was invariant. But there are famous cases where you can't do that. But you're right, you have to check it. All the examples I'm going to have, it's going to work. You know, the only cases where it doesn't happen are the ones that I know of, are the ones where the ones that where you have a space-time chirality of some sort. And you know, so either you have different numbers of left-handed fields as right-handed fields, or different proper quantum numbers for them, or it could be anti-symmetric tensors. If you have a self-dual anti-symmetric tensors, those are chiral things. And in that case, it's true that the definition of the measure, you know, those are the cases where you run into these measure problems. And a great, if you want, you know, I don't know if you've, you know, if there's papers by Alvarez Gomez and Witten, where back in the early 80s, people were trying to figure out anomalies in four and higher dimensions. And so there's some very nice reviews of the, why it's true that chiral fields are a problem. And I can actually, that could be one of the topics we do if people are interested. We could do anomalies. It's that's fits into the scope of QED. So when you're thinking about what we should do, that could be one of them. So I can see that it's 11:30. So the plan would be now, I wasn't going to say more about path integrals. I just wanted to say this amazing fact that, you know, I don't think I probably haven't said it yet. You know, the bottom line is that what's appearing in the thing that's appearing in the expression for the S matrix is now the time ordered product of the interaction Lagrangian. So if I had to write the S matrix out now, it would be, you know, so this is it would be, you know, one, but now it's not minus I, it's plus I. Times the integral d4x of the interaction Lagrangian, then plus I squared over 2 integral d4x, integral d4y of the t star product of the interaction Lagrangian. Plus, so it's as if H interaction was minus L interaction, which was actually true if you had no derivative interactions. And the T went to the T star thing, which had the T star, you remember, was defined to be, if I took derivatives of T star, that was T star of the derivatives. So it was a thing that didn't screw up the covariance. And so all these things that I've been telling you that, you know, if you're working with a Hamiltonian, the non-covariance coming from the time ordering, derivatives on the time ordering, you know, you throw those away because those are canceling pieces of the Hamiltonian, and you can figure out what the pieces of the Hamiltonian that are the difference between H is minus L plus non-covariant stuff, and all that cancellation that's happening that you see explicitly in the operator version now doesn't have to happen because this framework is giving you the answer with the as-if part being true. So you're getting everything as a function of the Lagrangian, and the path integral of two fields like this. In the operator language, it is the T star product because derivatives go inside it outside the path integral for free, and so that's the magic that's happened. And so, once you, and it's like when I learned this, the way it was phrased was, you know, it's like Jesus dying for your sins. You know, you don't have to do it every time you're doing a calculation. You can, you know, it's there working for you always. And so it's one of those things where this backstory, you should know that it's there, but the details of how it's working are usually not that important unless you come to a problem. And so what we'll do from now on is we'll just use this. That's kind of where what I intend to do. Okay, so see you guys, and it's at 2:30, it's in the room downstairs again.